Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Welcome to this second virtual collaboration between GMAL and the Tilburg Foundation. Our first collaboration focused on Congress. Today it's about economics. Still all about the U.S. and how are we going to cope with the presidency of Donald Trump? Our guest today is Marco Annunziato, whose most recent position was chief economist at GE, but who also has a deep history working with various international banks, the IMF, advising other international public and private institutions. I thought I'd start today's conversation by reading a few headlines from the media over the last hours. S&P jumps after EU agrees to fast-track trade talks. Wall Street braces for more bond turmoil. U.S. business activity improves in May, but inflation poised to accelerate sharply. The good, the bad, and the ugly in the one big beautiful bill. Imagine a world where we actually call legislation. It is the one big beautiful act. The U.S. to receive a golden share in U.S. Steel for approving the Nippon Steel merger. And finally, a Vermont startup was close to becoming profitable, then the tariffs hit. When we planned this session, we called it Voodoo Economics, but a better title might be Witch's Brew Economics, because there seems to be a little bit of everything and a lot that is unusual in the mix of U.S. economic policy these days under Donald Trump. Hopefully over the next hour or so, we can make some sense of it all. Marco, just in that short list of today's headlines, we have tariffs, taxes, industrial policy, deficit spending, and a Vermont startup that is now headed to the dustbin. I'm tempted to ask if that's voodoo or witchcraft, but I won't make you choose. Instead, let's start at 60,000 feet. When it comes to economics, what is the Trump administration trying to do?
It's a very interesting way of framing the question, Alan. First of all, thanks for having me. It's a huge pleasure and a huge honor. And saying it's a big question to ask in the sense that we need to make an assumption as to whether or not there is an underlying strategy in the economic policy of the current administration. And I'm saying this because at times, and I think your reference to a witch's brew alludes to it, at times it feels, in the implementation at least, quite erratic. I think, however, that the current administration is responding to some unresolved issues or some problems that in economic terms have emerged over the last couple of decades, and is trying in its own way to find a new path towards a different set of economic conditions. Let me be a bit more specific. So, what the administration has told us is that they want to reduce the trade deficit because they feel that America is being taken advantage of, and they want to bring back manufacturing into the United States as part of an effort to increase investment in the country. Now, this is the stated aim of the administration. The question is, do the policies actually move us closer to that destination? And I think it's a mixed bag. Tariffs by themselves are an inefficient way both of reducing the trade deficit and of incentivizing more production in the U.S., especially when they are used across the board and especially when they are announced and then taken back in a way that has felt so far very, very erratic. However, tariffs do have a place to play in a situation where the U.S. current account deficit is objectively too large and is objectively a problem. I think a lot of the weakness of the economic economic design of the administration so far, or rather the economic implementation, has been to put tariffs up front, leaving deregulation and tax policy on the back burner. Now, the emphasis is shifting now, and I think it will be crucial to see how much progress we make both on tax policy and deregulation, because those are the things that can give an impulse to growth. But to boil it down, Alan, I think this is the sense that the administration is giving us. They want to boost manufacturing and investment in the U.S. They want to reduce the current account deficit. They have some ways of getting there. There are some are good, some are less so. This leaves room for a variety of outcomes. So there is still the possibility of disastrous outcomes, there is still the possibility of positive outcomes. One of the headlines you read talked about the S&P jumping on news that there is an acceleration of discussions between the US and Europe. And the reason why you see the stock market collapsing and then jumping up again, I think is that investors realize that for all the disappointments and the ups and downs we've been put through, positive outcomes are still possible.
Let's talk about one of those possible outcomes. Any administration wants the sweet spot of high growth and low inflation. Everything else typically is in second, third, or fourth place. And arguably part of the reason Trump won is that at least half of Americans apparently remember fondly the first term when growth was pretty strong his first 3 years before the pandemic took hold. Inflation was quite low. And there's this nostalgia, can't we do that again? I saw Jason Smith, who's the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, talking the other day about the consequence he thought of the big, beautiful bill plus tariffs, which he said he thought in the short run, GDP is going to grow 4.5% to 5.5% and settle into 3% to 3.5% in the long run. Now, that sounds fantastical in the true meaning of the word. But is it even in your mind remotely possible that there is this golden outcome that could somehow miraculously happen? And then we're going to back. Do you explain well, but how that miracle of loaves and fishes could actually occur?
Everything is possible at this stage. Let me make one observation to start off with. You referenced the reason why Trump managed to win again last year. And I think part of it is, as you said, that the people are thinking back to his first term when we did get strong growth and relatively low inflation. Strong growth on the back of deregulation and low taxes. But I think the other reason why Trump won was that a number of people were worried about the policies of the past 4 years and what they would bring if they were to continue. The past 4 years saw a move towards increasingly intrusive regulation, gigantic increases in public spending, and the move towards, move away from a market-driven economy. And I think the election outcome has to be seen not in isolation as a referendum on Trump, but as a choice between two different paths. Now, if we have, with this big, beautiful bill, an entrenchment, a continuation of the low taxes that were set in stone in 2017, even with a whole lot of exceptions, even with changes to the tax code that are a lot less clean than we saw in 2017, that is positive for growth. That is a relief for the business sector compared to the prospect of a potentially significant increase in these tax rates. If we go to the route of towards the route of further deregulation, there is still room for the animal spirits of entrepreneurs to be refueled, reignited, and for growth to reaccelerate. Now, personally, I think numbers like 4.5%, 5% in the short run are very, very optimistic. I don't know if I call them fantastical, but certainly extremely optimistic. I would also say that the possibility of settling on a growth rate of 3% plus in the long term depends a lot on productivity and productivity growth. And that brings in other considerations. It ties into the issue of whether or not it makes sense to try to bring manufacturing back. It brings us to education. So it brings in a set of other different issues. But I would say growth of 3% plus is possible. It does require an effort to allow productivity to accelerate significantly.
Now, I imagine on behalf of people listening to us, I should ask not about possible, but about likely or probable. I promised I would not ask you to make forecasts because I know what you think of the current state of economic forecasting, which is that it's almost useless. But in terms of scenarios, so we have this sweet spot possibility or not impossibility, I would say. What about the other scenarios? What's likely in terms of scenarios, in terms of growth? And then let's take apart some of the pieces of trade, manufacturing.
I hate economic forecasting. I think it has very little value. But here I see...
And that's an economist speaking, by the way.
It's an economist speaking, exactly. So I know of what I speak about. But I would say the following. There is one potential positive outcome, which is, for the reasons we said before, if everything goes well, you could see an acceleration of growth towards 3%. You would still have higher inflation than we had before, because tariffs will lead to higher inflation, at least temporarily, and because we still have a large fiscal deficit spurring demand. So inflation would be higher. So there is one potentially positive scenario of robust growth, low unemployment, and high but not too high inflation. Now, in terms of the possible negative outcomes, what comes to mind is Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, when he said that every happy family is happy in the same way. Unhappy families are all unhappy in different ways. And I think you have a number of different outcomes, of different potential negative outcomes that are different from each other. But you can imagine one very negative outcome, which involves a re-escalation of the trade wars, and therefore a scenario of a recession, potentially even a global recession, with a significant increase in unemployment, and not just a recession, but even a stagflation scenario, in the sense that inflation would still be significantly, significantly high. The other negative scenario that I want to highlight as a risk is a financial shock caused by irresponsible fiscal policy, which would send interest rates spiking. It would cause a substantial correction in equity markets, which have very high valuations and therefore are vulnerable to such a correction, and a subsequent recession without the inflation spike. So these are the two ranges of outcomes. And frankly, I don't know which one is more likely. I'm hard-pressed to tell you that I believe a negative scenario is more likely than a positive one, or vice versa. I would almost tell you it's a coin toss, for a very simple reason that at this stage, it all depends on discretionary decisions by policymakers, and in particular by Trump. And we don't have a clue what he's thinking. So it's not even a matter of trying to understand economic trends which are ongoing. It's really trying to read a mind that almost by design has made itself unpredictable.
I'm trying to be polite, but I guess I have to ask, do you think there is a plan? Because you gave us one positive option, probably not the most likely, two negative options, scenarios, better word than option, one driven by trade wars. We're at least in the trade skirmish stage of that scenario. One driven by fiscal shock. We certainly are in the early stages of we're living with a very large deficit, and we've had some burps in the bond market recently. So we can easily imagine how that could happen. But I go back to the first question I asked you. What's Trump doing, do you think?
I think there is a plan. I think the risk is the extent to which Trump might be underestimating the risks of his actions. I think the plan includes a reshaping of trade policy, which ends up with the US imposing a 10% tariff across the board on everybody and possibly higher tariffs on China and somebody else, and in the negotiating process that leads us there, obtains some concessions from trading partners. This is, I think, is what the administration currently has in mind. If that is the case, as far as trade policy is concerned, a 10% across-the-board tariff sounds terrible, but it's equivalent to a 2% sales tax across the board. Now, if a different administration, if a less controversial administration had come in last month and or a few months ago and told us they were going to impose a 2% sales tax, nobody would have been screaming the apocalypse. So that is something that we can digest. There is a risk, however, that Trump ends up underestimating either the importance of our trade relationship with China or the importance of our trade relationship with the EU, and that leads to a collapse in trade flows that has much bigger repercussions on the US productive system. So that is a clear risk. Similarly, on fiscal policy, I think what he is thinking is that because he doesn't have the stomach for big expenditure cuts, he can play for a longer time on the strength of the dollar as a reserve currency and US treasuries as the safe asset of choice for the global economy, meaning he can afford to run large fiscal deficits for longer until, as he hopes, growth accelerates and starts reducing them. Now, that might work. There is a high risk that it doesn't, and that through a loss of investor confidence, you see a sharper rise in interest rates. So, and let's remember also that these are the risks implicit in the calibration of what I think are the administration's policy plans. There is always the risk of a shock hitting us from left field, which is what normally happens. And when you're running a policy which is on a knife edge, this leaves you very little room for any kind of reaction. So if you put it in very simple, concrete terms, if we had another shock of the COVID variety or the global financial crisis variety that requires in principle a large fiscal stimulus, we can't afford it without spooking markets at this stage. So to boil it down, this is how I would answer your question. I think this is what the plan of the administration is. I think there's a chance it can work. I think it leaves very little room for mistake.
Let's talk, though, about spooky markets. When we were trained as baby economists a long, long time ago, if you had told me that the U.S. would have debt, U.S. government would have debt in excess of 100% of GDP, that it would be running very large deficits, 6, 7% of GDP in a full employment economy, I would tell you not possible. The markets won't finance it. Fast forward to 2025, and the markets are financing it okay. It's a little more expensive than it was a moment ago, but only a little more expensive. You have a long bond in the 4.5 to 5% sort of range, which is only high relative to zero interest rate we got used to. So are these markets spookable? They're volatile. They bounce around like a casino, but It's like one of those bad rock and roll songs. The ball keeps on bouncing back to me. We're financing unbelievably large deficits, both trade deficits and fiscal deficits. So do we overestimate the risk of it's like playing with Mother Nature, of playing with Mother Market?
It is a very good point. And I think the reason... So I'm guessing here, but it feels to me like the reason why markets appear to be unspookable is that they still believe there is a failsafe, and the failsafe is the Fed stepping in again, because this is what's been happening over and over again over the past 20 years. The reason why we've been able to run such large fiscal deficits on a sustained basis with a limited cost is that the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve has increased first by a factor of 8 or 9, and it's down to a factor of 7 compared to what it was at the beginning of the global financial crisis.
Let me interrupt you, because most people don't think about the Fed's balance sheet. And what you just said, it's one of those things that had they told us that 20 years ago, we would say, oh, my God, you're going to blow the balance sheet up by 8 times and the world will go on quite happily. And we're all the way down to 7 times, which is a distinction without a difference. So what that means in practice is a massive amount of liquidity issued really since the start of the global financial crisis, and more with the COVID crisis, and then more after that. We never quite got to putting the jack back in the box, correct?
Correct. And I think we've seen over the past few years the risks that poses. We've seen inflation jump to 10%. If you had told me years ago that the U.S. was going to experience an inflation surge of 10%, which was then going to be sustained at high levels for about 3 years, I would have thought that would be very, very unlikely. But with this enormous amount of liquidity in circulation, the liquidity has to go somewhere, right? It's sloshing around. It sloshes in asset markets, creates very high valuations, and therefore creates the basis for the high volatility you were highlighting before. And when the conditions are right, it can slosh back into goods and services, creating spikes in inflation. So it's quite possible that this high liquidity will keep us plundering along for a little while longer with large deficits without accidents. It does increase the risk that something at some point goes massively wrong. And I think so one concern I have is that this amount of liquidity has created financial markets that are enormously volatile. There is a sense, I think, in investors that valuations are often uncomfortably high. And I think that is why you see the markets reacting with such sensitivity to economic news. So you've seen on Liberation Day an announcement of tariffs. The market absolutely collapsed, because not just because the tariffs were larger than anticipated, but also because of the lackadaisical way in which they were announced and imposed and calculated. And then the market bounced back completely, fully, erasing all the losses, simply because it now appears that, yes, you know, there are discussions ongoing and we might get to a better outcome. But I think that speaks more to the volatility created by high valuations rather than by any serious effort by investors to actually assess the risk that we're subject to.
I want to add 2 dimensions to what to sort of, you've begun to set the table here. One is the apparent obsession of the president and I guess his administration with manufacturing. There seems to be a nostalgia for a point in some distant past when the United States was a big manufacturing company, a country. Today, manufacturing accounts for something like 10% of GDP and less than that of employment. And one wonders whether that should matter to anybody, although it clearly does matter to Donald Trump. Indeed, part of the point of tariffs supposedly is to tariff people into behavior that repatriates manufacturing, although I'm not even sure what those words mean, because we don't have a trained labor force, we don't have unused factory capacity, we don't have, and we sure as hell can't make Apple phones in the United States because of the very particular nature of their supply chain and the complexity of their supply chain. So talk a bit about how you think about manufacturing. Is it something we ought to be worried about?
I do think we should be worried about manufacturing. And to sum it up, keep in mind, I spent a number of years in the manufacturing sector with GE. So that probably biases my view, although I think it also gives me more of an insight into the issue. But let me give you and the audience a few numbers. So since 2000, so over the last 25 years, the entire job creation, the entire employment creation in the US has come from four sectors: government, healthcare, hospitality, and professional services. Right now, in the US, the biggest employer is government, followed by healthcare, retail trade, and hospitality. These four sectors account for almost half of all jobs.
And now, government includes not just federal government, but state and local.
It's actually mostly local, mostly state and local. It's mostly state and local. And the question is, does it matter? Well, since 2000, real value added for employees, so essentially productivity, has doubled in the manufacturing sector. And this is what drives the potential for wage increases, income increases. So in the manufacturing sector, it doubled compared to a 40% increase economy-wide. The large employing sectors and the sectors which have large employment growth, like healthcare, professional services, and government, have much, much lower, below average productivity growth. So if you are allowing yourself to let the manufacturing sector be eroded continuously, you are losing the main engine of productivity growth for the country, and therefore the main engine of wage growth and income growth. Now, there are economists who say that this is just part of the natural evolution of an economy. That it's normal, first you're in agriculture, then you move from agriculture to industry, and then as you become more and more advanced, you shift to services. But that is true only up to a point. As you've mentioned, Alan, in the US, manufacturing accounts for 10% of GDP. In countries like Germany, Japan, Korea, that ratio is almost double, 19 to 20%. Then people say that, well, even if you bring manufacturing back, it will all be automated, so it won't matter to employment. Well, maybe. Over the period when the US lost 1.5 million jobs in manufacturing, Germany gained almost 500,000 jobs in manufacturing. It's hard to argue that German manufacturing is less high-tech or automated than the US. So in my view, manufacturing, and I'll make one last point, which is actually, I think, the most important observation from my own personal experience at GE. Having product manufacturing and product design together does have a strong impact on accelerating innovation. And we're seeing the flip side of that. We've seen China cornering the global manufacturing sector. And initially, nobody was worried because everybody said, well, they're just copying and it doesn't matter. But by having manufacturing, they have learned to innovate, and now they're innovating very effectively. So for all these reasons, I think we do need to be worried about manufacturing. Now, we need to have the smart policies to bring it back. You mentioned the issue of skills, which brings us back to education. It's a very important point. But I think the concern about manufacturing is a valid concern, and it's not just nostalgia for the 50s.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Let me add just one more bit to the witch's brew, and that's the dollar. The United States economy sits in a larger global economy. The intersection point is obviously measured by the value of the dollar, which has pretty consistently fallen over the early parts of this administration, which at the very least says that we're leaking capital by definition. The rest of the world seems to be losing confidence in American leadership, in American reliability, and perhaps in the American economy. And I don't know if that's overstating the fall of the dollar and what it means, but how does that piece come together for you? And how worried are you about a structurally weak dollar beginning to emerge?
I think we are seeing the beginning of a period of structurally weak dollar. I would say that we need to put it in perspective and realize that we've come into 2025 with the dollar at the peak of a period of enormous record strength. So some of the weakening of the dollar, I think, is physiological. Similarly, I think some of the leaking out of capital from U.S. equity markets that you pointed out is also physiological and can also be ascribed to valuations. However, it is equally true that there is an ongoing loss of confidence in U.S. economic policy and U.S. geopolitical leadership. I don't think this started in the last 4 months. I think it's been going on for a number of years. And I think it's actually, in my mind, it's a bipartisan responsibility. But it is happening. And I think the poor quality of the economic policies of the last couple of decades, which have emphasized demand stimulus, both through large fiscal deficits and easy monetary policy, have to shoulder a lot of the blame for this. I think it's something that we need to be concerned about because as you said, the U.S. does not operate in a vacuum. Now, the temptation is to go from one extreme to the other. One extreme is the people who will tell you that we are on the verge of the U.S. losing its leadership, the U.S. dollar losing its role as a global reserve currency. That's not true because there are no viable alternatives at the moment. It's also not true because when we touch on these arguments, we instinctively tend to look at countries like or regions like Europe as the alternative. And I think Europe is structurally weaker than the US and will remain so. But we tend to forget what's happening in Asia with the rise of China, with the strengthening of India, with other robust economies like Japan and Australia, and the fact that the shift of the global GDP or the makeup of the global economy is shifting eastwards, it is shifting towards Asia. So I think this erosion of confidence in U.S. leadership is something we should take seriously, is something that at all levels we should look at and recognize that it is to some extent justified. We have to some extent lost our way, our focus on what made the U.S. economy so far the most dynamic economy in the world. And maybe it's time to consider what we're doing wrong and correct course.
Well, let me stay just for a moment with Asia and China. China is or will soon be the largest economy in the world. Whether that matters or not is a different issue. It surely is the largest economy in Asia, dominates Asian trade. Why wouldn't you expect that at some point they would want to shift away from the dollar as the clearinghouse mechanism, which is in our U.S. interest, not necessarily in their Chinese interest? And we know in a number of cases where they are encouraging their counterparts, ranging from Argentina to the Saudis to people closer to home, to indeed not clear through dollars, but clear through renminbi or some digital alternative. Wouldn't you expect that naturally to happen as they become more dominant, even in just their own, and I air quotes on just, their own Asian space?
I would say that it is happening, but it's a very different thing from displacing the dollar as the reserve currency in the way we understand it today. Because there is a key difference between China agreeing with some of its trading partners, hey, let's trade in renminbi, and China saying, okay, we are now going to make our capital account fully convertible, our financial system fully open, so that the renminbi can actually become the global reserve currency. They are not prepared for that. Their system is entirely closed. You cannot freely convert the renminbi. You cannot freely take money out of China. So those are big steps China would need to take before the renminbi actually displaces the dollar. Now, the risk is that if the U.S. really, really, really loses its primacy, so if deterioration of U.S. policies goes a lot further for a lot longer, we could go back to a world which is ruled by bilateral relationships, especially tied to China, and it would be a very different world from the one we have today. It would not be today's world with China having replaced the U.S.
Let's stay in the capital account for a minute. Market economies, Europe and elsewhere, are running very large deficits as well. The new German government talks about €1 trillion in military spending, all of it financed by borrowing. The EU, every time they see a problem, they talk about more EU borrowing. Doesn't that mean that the debt markets are going to be under pressure independent from what we do, but with feedback loops going back and forth, worsening the potential impact on interest rates, et cetera?
It does. And I'm very worried that this policy thinking is lagging behind reality by several years. So the idea, as you pointed out, in Europe of throwing more money and counting on more borrowing to address any problem seems to be anchored by the experience we had between the global financial crisis and COVID, when borrowing was pretty much free. Now it isn't anymore. One point you made earlier, Alan, I think is very important. We look at borrowing rates on 10-year U.S. government bonds around 4.5%. That's where they should be. With real growth, say, in the range of 2% and an inflation target of 2%.
It's arithmetic.
You expect those rates to be 4.5%. This is the new world. If in this new world governments continue to pile more and more debt, there are two possibilities. Either we face significant further increases in borrowing costs and interest rates because the market has to absorb it, or we go into a world where central banks, and not just the Fed, but the ECB, effectively lose their independence, whether or not this is codified by changes in law. If they are de facto forced to be the buyer of first reserve for governments, they lose their independence. And then we have financial instability, we have higher inflation risks. So I think this attitude of counting more and more on borrowing when government debts have already increased so much is irresponsible.
But likely to continue.
And sadly, likely to continue to take the emphasis away from supply side. This is what's been driving me nuts for the last several years. That the focus is always on how do we stimulate demand. And that can be a temporary problem, like when you have the COVID shutdowns, when you have the global financial crisis at the beginning, but it can't be a sustained permanent policy emphasis. The emphasis has to be on how you stimulate supply.
Let's stay global for a moment before we shift back domestically. I grew up in a world where the G7 was created. I was a very junior officer at the Treasury when the G7 first started meeting. We've had all sorts of really concerted efforts, Republican and Democrat, over the years to build a strong, mutually serving set of both institutions and processes and procedures. So every time there's a dollar crisis, the Europeans help, Japanese help. Every time there's a euro crisis, vice versa, et cetera. Will this administration eventually have to rebuild its relationships? Because they seem to have done more tearing them up, but so too did some of its predecessors, more tearing it up than building. Can we be as unilateral as American policymakers want to be?
No, because as you pointed out, the world actually is even more interconnected than it was when you and I started our careers. So some degree of cooperation is more important than ever. I think where the current administration does have a point is that many of our allies over the past 20 years have sort of taken the U.S. economic and political leadership for granted, partly because we seem to live in a world where either everything was okay or any problem could easily be solved by throwing more borrowed government money at it. And I think there needs to be a global recognition that this is no longer the world we are in. As that recognition consolidates, and this administration and the following administrations in the U.S. do need to rebuild bridges with our allies, and they need to figure out, equally importantly, how to work with countries like China that might not be ideologically aligned with our values, but have grown in economic importance so much that some way of working together must be found. But definitely some progress, some rebuilding and reshaping of international cooperation will be necessary.
I said I was going to move domestic, but let me stay not in the United States for a minute, because you just returned, and I can see it in your eyes, you just returned from Japan. How are the Japanese, what are the Japanese thinking about all this? They are keen observers of the United States. They have vested interest. They are still one of our largest creditors outside the United States. How worried are they?
They are worried, but not panicking. So from the limited observations that I've collected, I would say the following, Alan. They are still constructively hopeful, if not convinced, that on trade relationship, they can find a constructive agreement with the U.S. administration. They believe that after the dust has settled, the trade relationship, the trade discussions between the U.S. and most other countries will also settle on reasonable agreements. So the Japanese don't seem to be too concerned about an unraveling of the global trade system. They are somewhat more uncertain when it comes to the evaluation of the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China, and the relationship between China and everybody else, including Japan. Clearly, in Asia, this is a big deal. So for countries like Japan, but also Australia, Korea, how to interact with China depends on how the relationship between China and the U.S. evolves. And I think on this front is where, for Japan, the current degree of U.S. unpredictability is quite disturbing.
One of the threads I want to pull on, you've just a couple times alluded to sort of a notion that we're in a period of policy turmoil as this administration has taken power, has more or less said everything that comes before we want to rip up and do something different. Whether it be tariffs, whether it be regulation, and so forth, so on, industrial policies. And the assumption is that it's like you're crossing a river and you're going somewhere and you get to a new steady state. And then once you're in this new steady state, everything will be fine, even if you don't particularly like it, but it will be predictable, which is policy ought to be. We will stop getting 145% tariffs one day, no, 20% the next day, that we're headed to the other side of a river. Do you really believe that?
I know you hope it, but do you believe it?
You've made two points that I think are worth digging in. And they're the reason why I can't give you a yes or no answer. So let me, and I promise you, I'm not trying to do the economist trick of saying, well, on the one hand, on the other hand. But what I want to say, Alan, is the following. So the administration, as you said, does seem to indicate that what they want to do is implement a major transformation of all economic relations, both domestically and externally, globally. And once this is done, we will be in a much better world where the U.S. will be better off. I think this, number one, this, I don't believe it in the sense that this is underestimating the difficulty of the transition. So even if you set aside the erratic way in which the transition is being managed, and especially on the tariff side, even if you want to get to that other stage where you have higher tariffs and you restructure relationships, you don't do it in this way. You don't do it with such unpredictable tariff announcements. But even if in the end you do it and you get to a place where tariffs are higher with most of our trading partners, and you settle and we get to the point where there is no longer uncertainty on what tariff rates will be tomorrow, then the real economy needs to adjust. The supply chains need to adjust. That takes time. So I think there is an underestimation of how long and painful the process will be to reach the new steady state. And maybe the new steady state is so good that the transition cost is worth paying, but there will be a transition pain. The second point I want to make, Alan, is
you believe there is a steady state out there somewhere.
I believe there is. Whether this administration has the capacity of getting us there, I genuinely don't know. Potentially they do. They're creating, partly by design, so much uncertainty and kicking up so much dust that you can't be sure whether they do or they don't. But there is a steady state out there which has, and it's not a considerably worse steady state across the board than the one we have now. If it's a steady state where we have more manufacturing in the US, when there is less consumption in the US because we're taking on less debt, there is not necessarily a worse equilibrium than the one we are in now. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, Alan, is you've mentioned industrial policy. And that is something that worries me because I've been brutally critical of the Biden administration. I think the Biden administration and the Obama administration before that have implemented some policies that are destructive of the capacity of the U.S. to continue to be a successful market economy. However, if Trump comes in and tells me, well, I agree with you, and I want to move us back to an economy which has leaner regulation, lower taxes, I'm all for it. I would say, great, let's try. What worries me, however, is that there are ways in which the Trump administration doesn't look too different from the Biden administration. There is very little appetite to reduce public spending. So
that could get you canceled, you know.
I know. But, you know, if you look at the history of my presentations and blogs over the last 10 years, it's full of stuff that should get me canceled. So I'm beyond worrying about that. But the fiscal deficit will be marginally smaller or marginally larger than it is. There's no plan to consolidate fiscal policy. And there is a design to implement a different form of industrial policy than Biden, but still an industrial policy, which means there is still a desire to have the government guide what the economy does and how, in a way which is relies much more on micromanaging than in saying at the macro level, we should have more manufacturing, let's create better conditions for investment.
And your worry that slippery slope, whether it's the industrial policy of the Democratic administrations or of the Republican administrations, it's still industrial policy, and it is messing up the allocation of resources.
Correct. Because I think industrial policy from the government almost never works. The government is very poorly qualified to decide exactly which sectors and exactly with which companies are likely to succeed. And if it tries to do that, it messes up the incentives, which leads to a misallocation of resources, which leads to lower productivity growth and lower growth overall. So that worries me. And I see some of these temptations still being quite strong in the current administration as well.
You mentioned productivity, so let's go to artificial intelligence. Is that the solution to our productivity challenges? We've seen some impact of AI on productivity, although it seems to be flattening out recently. How optimistic are you that technology gets us into that sweet spot of 3% plus growth, even if we mismanage some things like the deficit and tariff policy and industrial policy along the way? Can AI save us?
Not confident at all. because I think what you're seeing is, and this might tie us back to the issue of manufacturing, but I think the benefits that a new technology, and particularly digital technology, gives you depend on the makeup of your economy, and they depend on the incentives within your economy. Now, let me be more concrete. When we had the first productivity boom driven by digital technology started in the mid-90s, at the time, productivity growth accelerated, doubled in the U.S. from about 1.5% per year to 3% per year. At the time, however, the U.S. economy was different. Manufacturing was still 16 to 17% of the U.S. economy. And a lot of the productivity benefits materialized in manufacturing. When I look at what is happening in artificial intelligence now, I worry that most of the emphasis is on applications of artificial intelligence to advertising. And advertising, PR, maybe something in back office operations, in finance, etc. And that's not going to be enough. Now, keep in mind that it takes a long time. We've seen how painful it is to get the Industry 4.0 digital innovations to get some traction in the manufacturing sector, because companies have to rework their operations, rearrange their processes, upgrade their workforce. But if you're in a situation where artificial intelligence just goes into advertising because that's where the money is, that's not going to buy you a productivity miracle.
And hence won't buy you growth.
And hence will not buy you growth. It will just buy you more income inequality.
Do you think this administration has the team to execute the kind of really dramatic reorganization of not just the domestic, but the global economy that you described seems to be where the president and the vice president want to go?
No. I think that the clear answer is no, but I do have some hope that this is where my inclination and my faith in markets kicks in, because I would tell you they don't necessarily have to. So if they get a few simple things right and then they take their hands off the wheel, the transition can still work out through lower taxes, deregulation, leaving a bit more space to the private sector. If they try to do more and to micromanage this transition to a much greater extent, right now I don't see convincing evidence that the people in the administration are good enough to do it.
That is definitive. Question, though. We've had the president recently demand that Walmart eat its tariffs, which is to say, shrink its profits. We've had him tell Apple, you will bring everything home now, which actually is physically impossible. We've heard commentary that seems to imply the possibility of capital controls. There is a dirigiste piece of the thinking there that is a bit King Canute-like, I suspect, but I personally think incredibly dangerous, because it's part of the model that you just suggested. If we move further in that direction of a very centralized attempted management of managed flows, it won't end well. Do you worry about it?
I worry about it a lot, because it's a different form of government intervention. Whenever you have governments playing a bigger role in the economy, companies and individuals naturally put more of their energy into managing the relationship with the government than anything else. So if you create a situation like this with the U.S. president threatening individual companies, naturally these companies will worry a lot more about how do they manage the relationship with the administration rather than how do they run their business. And that is not what you want. This is not what's conducive to healthy economic growth. So this is exactly the wrong approach, and I worry about it a lot.
Mark, I want to thank you for this conversation. Economists usually end up being shades of black. There is no upside to anything. It's not possible. We're all going to die, et cetera, and die poor on top of it. So I want to thank you for demonstrating there are alternatives. It's a little black, but it's not all that black. Again, thank you very much for that.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.